Hi everyone, and welcome to Pixels, a podcast for the discerning gamer. And welcome back to Pixels. This is a show where we cover the news from the video game world from the past couple of weeks. My name is Patrick Beja, and well, you might be a little bit surprised if you listened to the last episode to hear me come back to you so soon, or so, I don't know, to be back here, because I'm supposed to be on parental leave. But guess what? Everyone who was saying the baby is going to come early was wrong. And it's actually pretty late. The due date was a few days ago. And so I was like, well, what am I, you know, I'm twiddling my turning my thumbs or something. And well, let's do a show. So I called up Ed and I was like, dude, do you want to wake up super early on a Saturday morning to do an episode of Pixels? And he was like, and I was like, excellent. I'll talk to you tomorrow. And here you are. So thanks for being on.
Yeah, you're welcome. Sorry I missed last podcast. So you're going to have me on for that, and I came down with something, so I'm glad to be back.
Well, I'm getting back at you now. So it's all good.
Serves me right.
Right, and we have a few things to talk about. And so it's good because I'm guessing that at some point in the next few days, the baby is finally going to arrive. So I'm going to have less time at that point. Although, you know, I'm sort of in a place now where it's like, you know what? Maybe it's going to stay in there. Maybe it's just comfortable. It's not going to come out. Maybe that's our life now.
That's just your life now.
Yeah, exactly. So, right. But enough with baby talk. We do have things to talk about in the gaming world, and we have Nintendo that announced something quite surprising. We have a couple of games that are coming out very soon. We have a bunch of games that we tried that we're going to talk about, because why not? It's a relatively quiet week or couple of weeks, and a bunch of news. Some of them are a little bit sadness inducing for the games we used to love. But let's start with Nintendo and their announcement of Nintendo Labo, which was, I'm pretty sure no one could have predicted something like this. And the reactions were, I want to say, mixed. At least in France, people were a little bit not convinced, let's say. But let's start with what it is. I'm sure many of you have heard about the cardboard Nintendo thing that they announced, and they were very careful to say this is going to be a new, different way to play with your Nintendo Switch, aimed at children or at people who are children at heart, I guess. And the way it works is that they have complex pre-cut cardboard that you have to assemble, you know, bend and attach, and they have like elastic bands and rope bits and things like that, and like reflective surfaces, and you make cardboard toys, which are, you know, pretty sturdy cardboard. It's not the flimsy thing that is going to be destroyed after a couple of hours, or at least hopefully. And they're somewhat complex things to assemble. It doesn't take, you know, 10 minutes. Some of them take a couple of hours. And there are things like pianos, fishing rods, bikes, a giant robot one that is one game in itself. And of course, it comes with the software as well. And so you put your Switch controllers in parts of it and your screen in parts of it, and it makes for different kind of toys. And the cardboard portions are called the Toy-Cons, which is, of course, reminiscent of Joy-Cons, the controllers themselves. And so it's things like little, like, how do you call them? Like carts that you put the controller in, and through vibration, Yeah, there's a slot for the controller, and through vibration, it's going to move. Like, it's actually going to be a little car that moves around, and you can control it because you can control the vibration. The piano, which we mentioned, the motorbike that we mentioned as well. So, and there are two bundles, one with a number of different cardboards and games, which are most of the ones I mentioned, which is about $70. And the other one is a robot. Like, you actually create kind of a robot suit for yourself or for the kid. And you have like levers and pulleys and strings that pull on stuff that translate into movement in the game that you're looking at. So yeah, it's something unexpected. What do you think of it? Is it a good move for Nintendo? Is it something you're interested in personally? What do you think?
So at first I was like, what am I looking at here, right? especially the one that really blew my mind, and now I kind of understand how it works, but the one that blew my mind was the piano. And I was like, how is that working with like no cables and stuff? And then I remembered the right Joy-Con has an IR receiver on the end of it.
I think that one, the way it works is that they have reflexive tape on the bits that, right. And it's the IR receiver, or maybe even the camera. I don't know. But it's visual. It's optics.
Yeah, it's the same way that if you've played the 1-2 Switch game where you had to eat the like sandwiches or something like that. It's the same idea where you can, it can tell how far away it is from your mouth and like when your mouth closes. Okay. So it's pretty cool. And just the fact that there's like no wires or anything connected to this thing. It's just like cardboard, and you can literally take a piece of cardboard and cut it up in this like fashion and create the same thing. And they said that they are making the like APIs and stuff more available and like more documented for different people to use. So I could see the steering wheel becoming a common thing with racing games and like just more and more things being built off.
Yeah, or even some kind of a maker community that would get together and create things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, potentially it could happen. I think, it will be a little bit less than people who are very enthusiastic about it are hoping for, but I guess it could spawn something.
Yeah, I mean, and it's definitely like targeted towards kids and getting them in. It could even like have some applications towards like games that are for education purposes and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just the potentials are fairly endless with this kind of idea. And I mean, I was absolutely blown away by I guess I just wasn't expecting it, like you said.
Right. I think it's interesting. It's got potential. It's going to rest. The success is going to rest on the whether or not the magic happens when you blend some physical things with the screen and electronics of the components of the Switch, because I guess all of the educational aspects could be achieved with Legos or Playmobiles or whatever kind of toys you want to talk about. The magic here is that you can have the screen aspect of it interact with the physical world, and then it can become something more. We'll have to wait and see if it actually does become something more. I'm also a little bit, it's gonna. They mentioned it's gonna take a couple of hours to put together some of those. So it's not simple things. I'm not sure a lot of people are gonna be able to. You can't just get a piece of cardboard, fold it three times, and get a toy for this. It's some pretty, even though it's cardboard, I think it's some pretty serious engineering. What we might see is some Chinese or other types of factories that are going to sell knockoffs off Amazon for cheaper, or maybe some people are going to figure out some ways to do some different things in the same style. I don't think we're going to see everyone from home. Even how do you cut the cardboard in the way that it works properly? Maybe some people are going to figure it out, but I think it's more complicated than people expect. We had a somewhat negative reaction from a faction of the gaming population in France that were saying, oh, $70 for a piece of cardboard, that's ridiculous, which I thought in itself was kind of dumb because obviously you're not paying just for the cardboard. You're paying for the research and engineering and the game, you know, that's designed and the success of the company and the Switch. But did you have that kind of reaction in the US as well? Or
yeah, I mean, that was definitely one of the initial reactions to it. I think that people kind of jumped on it and saw like, oh, $70 or $80 for the robot one and thought it was craziness. But having the game that came with it kind of made sense, even if the game is just a bunch of mini games, but they sold 1-2 Switch for $60 too. So,
which arguably was too expensive, I would say.
Yeah,
but I think if you have a kid and you want to have fun in that way in a physical manner, I think it's absolutely, you know, it's a game, and I don't think, yeah. I mean, maybe some people would argue, oh well, if it was $50, it would be okay, and then you're like, dude, okay, all right, you know, whatever. It's kind of okay. You're gonna throw a stink for the $20 with obviously the success of the Switch allows Nintendo for. Setting their prices a little bit higher. And that's what I always say. I think it's, if it works, it's worth that amount of money. Probably if you spend, you know, a week worth of fun with your kid for $70, it seems like it would be, you know, taking them to a movie is probably $20 for the both of you, if not more, for probably 30. So anyway, and what I always say is those companies, when they set the price initially, they can always lower it if it's too high and the people don't respond to it. But increasing a price if you have a huge success is almost impossible. I mean, it is impossible.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising that with the success of the Switch, Nintendo is trying to, maybe they set it to $10 more expensive than they should have if things were not as successful. But it's also interesting to see Nintendo trying to expand the range of the Switch to get people that are maybe a little bit of a different kind of player and differentiating themselves from Sony and Microsoft, which is something they've always done since the Wii. And it was a conscious choice at the time that they were going to do something more, you know, not just compete with high, super powerful console with killer games, right? I mean, like, core games. Obviously, they have a lot of very successful games, as we've seen with the first year of the Switch, but they also try to do other things. And they've always done that to an extent. I mean, they're originally a trading, playing cards company, and they've done things like, you know, I don't know if you remember the robot from the NES. I mean, you probably weren't born, but
I lightly remember the NES. Thank you.
The NES. You know, do you remember that robot? Like that?
No.
No, okay, see, there you go. That's why you were so so quiet in your rebuttal of my insult. But yeah, they had that little robot thing that I bought in the 80s. But anyway, so we'll see how it goes. But I think it's an interesting idea, and it's going to bring... And it's funny that they were so clear about the fact that it's a toy kind of thing for kids, and still people were like, oh, Nintendo hates gaming. And you're like, dude.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like, the people's reactions to the pre-announcement was like, they said it's going to be for kids. And then they were like, the reaction afterwards was, this wasn't Smash. I wanted Smash.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, this is going to be for kids. Oh, okay. And then they announced it. And people are like, oh, what the hell? This is for kids. And they're like, okay. Well, anyway, so... interesting concept. I'm curious to see where it goes. And we'll see. It's going to be out in April, on April 20th, I believe. And there are still some details that are going to be coming out. So Nintendo Labo. It's for kids. That's the thing you should remember. Also, there are games coming next week. 2018, we had a brief respite in, you know, after the holidays, and now the season of gaming is starting up again in just a few days with two pretty big Japanese bred games coming out on the 26th. That's Monster Hunter World and Dragon Ball FighterZ Z, or Dragon Ball Fighters. Monster Hunter World, I think Monster Hunter is a series we've talked about a few times, and always with the same, how can we say it, longing for the joy that Monster Hunter seems to bring to people who love it without being able to access it. And apparently Monster Hunter World is more accessible. That's what everyone's been saying. And so maybe that's going to be the thing. They also, Bandai Namco also started a website called Adopt a Hunter or something like that, where you say when you are available and veteran players can accompany you into that world because it's very multiplayer centric. And so it can introduce you to the world in a more, you know, enjoyable manner. So, yeah, I would love to try it. I think I'm going to be busy with other things, although I've been saying that for like 3 weeks and it's still not happening. So maybe I'll still have time. But I'm curious, are you going to jump in? Are you going to try and discover the wonders of Monster Hunter?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the games that I was looking out for this year. And it, the fact that it comes out around a time when like nothing else is really happening, except for a couple like choice indie games and stuff like that, then I think it might be worth my time to check it out. Yeah. I mean, my other option is I just keep playing games that I missed last year. So,
and there are many of those, yeah.
But, oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's really, I think the allure of Monster Hunter World is pretty significant because they are promising some, you know, some easier interface elements and easier to get into. So the fans of that series are so rabid and so enjoying it that I think it's very difficult if you're a gaming fan to not want to at least try to get into that that series, because it's so big, especially in Japan. The other game is Dragon Ball Fighter Z, and they had a beta over the weekend. Did you try it at all? Or
no, I mean, this isn't my kind of game. Ah. We've talked about fighting games in the past, Patrick, and
well,
not my thing.
Okay, so I'm a big Dragon Ball fan, and it's Capcom, not Bandai Namco. Well, I had a doubt, so I was Googling it as I was saying. Of course, Monster Hunter is Capcom, and Dragon Ball is Bandai Namco. I crossed my signals there. And so they had a beta. I, of course, tried it because I'm a big Dragon Ball fan. That's basically my generation's Naruto, or I don't know what the kids are enjoying these days, but last, you know, 10 years it was Naruto. And the game itself, as we've said many times, looks amazing. It plays pretty well. There were issues with the beta. The networking wasn't working great, and it was very difficult to get into the actual game for a good portion of it, so much so that they had to extend it to allow people to play it a little bit. And I think it's a game that is going to be fun, as you would expect, if you enjoy Dragon Ball at all. And if you enjoy fighting games, I think you might want to take a look at it, maybe. But it's mostly for Dragon Ball fans. I'm gonna wait to see if the network code is, you know, the network is holding, and maybe I'll buy it. I think it's very enjoyable, and visually it's incredible. It is as striking as we suspected when we saw the first trailers. They're not lying at all. It's incredibly well crafted. So
did you play Xenoverse, the
yeah,
two Xenoverse games?
Was
the net code for that pretty good?
So Xenoverse is very different because it's very much of it's a 3D fighting game, right? So
okay,
you roam around in the world and it's very free. And Dragon Ball FighterZ is very much a 2D classical game.
Right.
So you're on a plane. It's more like, you know, Mortal Kombat or Street Fighter, that kind of thing. And it does that really well. And it's fairly accessible, but it's still, you know. So, I don't know. I think I'll wait and see. Right after I played the beta, I was like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. I want to play it all the time. And now I'm a little bit less. You know, I played again a little bit, and it's very fun. But I think there are other things that are also calling my attention. So, anyway, I'm not going to spend too much time on it. I'm sure the people who enjoy Dragon Ball have, you know, are all over it already. And those who don't really don't care. And I guess the lesson is, if you don't care about Dragon Ball, I don't think you should care about this game. It's not so good that it warrants your attention. A game that might warrant your attention, however, is a game that I played. We're going to be talking about, as I said, a few games that we started playing over the last few days. And one that has become really interesting is Street Fighter V, because if you don't know, again, fighting game, I know not everyone is a fan, so I'm going to go over it real quick, but Street Fighter V was released 2 years ago and had a real rough start. Like, it was network, the network was not stable at all. There were issues of the design of the game didn't allow them to track people who were just disconnecting and punishing them. So they had to add this like maybe a year in, which meant that when someone was starting to lose, they would just disconnect. And that was so frustrating and annoying. So anyway, they've improved the game over the last 2 years, and now they released the Arcade Edition, which is a free update for everyone who already owns the game, but it just updates the systems and the modes and all of that, but it doesn't add the characters that have been added over the last 2 years. However, if you buy the game fresh, the Arcade Edition itself, you get everything together. And the Arcade Edition is $40. And if you have the base game, you can now purchase the characters from Seasons 1 and 2 at a reduced price, which is $10 for Season 1 and $15, I think, for Season 2. So I went ahead and bought all of those characters. And they have a new season now, Season 3, that which is also going to add 6 additional characters over the next year. So I think now it has become a really good game, and it is pretty good value for money. I mean, $40, you get 28 characters and all of the goodies from the game itself if you buy the arcade edition fresh. So it's still Street Fighter. I mean, if you're not into Street Fighter, it's probably not going to be for you. If you want a very, very, very robust single-player experience, it's probably not going to be for you either. Although there are, like, there's an arcade mode, there's a story mode, but they're pretty weak. The core of the game is still the basic, you know, 1v1 gameplay. But it is, you know, a pretty compelling experience now. I spent a bunch of hours since, you know, in the last week when we got, just before and after we got the Arcade Edition. And it, man, it's a fun fighting game. I think I would say if you have bought it before and didn't stop playing it because it was unmanageable, get back into it. It might be interesting. If you were playing Street Fighter when you were younger and you've fallen off of fighting games, Arcade Edition might be a really fun time to spend. I say it's not a single-player game. Obviously, it isn't. I would say if you want to play online, yes. But even more so, if you have a friend or a group of friends and you want to have fun playing a fighting game, you know, couch versus type of thing, it is awesome. This and Tekken 7, obviously, is even more approachable, probably. Someone was asking me on Twitter recently, what fighting game should I try if I want to get into it and I'm not already proficient? I think Tekken 7 is a little bit more forgiving because you can just mash the buttons and fun things happen, on top of it having a very deep gameplay mastery curve. But Street Fighter V is, I think, a really good fighting game, and has now become a very recommendable game with the Arcade Edition having finally arrived. So, anyway, that is my recommendation of Street Fighter V. You've been playing a game from December, Xenoblade Chronicles 2 on the Switch, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a game that came out in December, and it is a long game. So I've been playing it basically since it came out, and continue to play it. So I was a huge fan of the original Xenoblade Chronicles. When it came out on the Wii, I pretty much played like 120 hours of it. I was loving it so much. And then Xenoblade Chronicles X came out for the Wii U, and I was a little less positive about that game, but still liked it enough. But with Xenoblade Chronicles 2, they really took the game and condensed it down into like kind of what makes it great. And for those of you that don't know, the style of combat for the original first two games was you had this long thing of arts, and you would basically go between the different arts to select them and use them in combat. But they condensed that system down to basically you only get to choose three arts, and each character has four to choose from. And then depending on your playstyle, you can switch them up. And the three arts that you choose are basically Y, X, and B on the controller. And then
so
A
it's
is
abilities, basically. What you're calling arts is just...
Yeah, yeah, they're just called arts in the game. Okay. And the combat system is actually pretty interesting once you get deep enough into the game where you start having to deal with elemental powers, and then after you use a... You can have different chain attacks with your party. So you basically use arts to build up a chain. And then once you use enough arts, you get the ability to use a special move. And there's different ranks of special moves depending on how much you've let it build up. So you basically can use 1, 2, and 3 of your ranks in order to use a greater ability. And then you can do this chain attack thing where all your party attacks at once. And the gameplay is like paused during that. But what I really found interesting, besides the combat, which kind of pulls you along through the game, is that I think the story is really interesting, which Xenoblade's well known for their stories. And I think that there are some elements of it that are kind of like, it seems like anime writers were the people that wrote the story, especially the side stuff. But the main story thread that's kind of pulling you through is really interesting and keeping me going. So if you want a big, like, large, bombastic RPG that for the Switch that isn't like, it seems more like a first party developed game, because it is, it's more like second party, but you get the idea. Mm. Like a shorter indie game, then I think I highly recommend it.
How JRPG is it? How Japanese and how, you know, grindy and how cringeworthy is it if you're, you know?
So just for the grinding part, there's a bunch of you get a bunch of side quests and stuff like that. And if you do all the side quests that you kind of come across as you come across them before you move on to the rest of the story, you end up being a little bit over leveled for the story stuff, which is fine by me. I kind of prefer it that way. So I don't know what would happen if you like go straight from story point to story point, whether you would need to do some grinding. But basically the option is there for you to either grind if you wanted to, but really it's probably more beneficial for you to just do the questing to get your experience.
Okay.
For the cringiness level of it, it's there's some things. There's like, so you have these things called blades, which are like synthetic beings that are real like beings, and they can talk and interact with people. But
they're the Xenoblades. That's
yeah,
what
yeah.
it is, right? Okay.
Yeah, well, there's this thing. They're just called blades, and it's not okay. like related to the previous Xenoblade game or Xenoblade X, really.
Okay. It's not just the sequel, like in the story.
No. Okay. I think it's just kind of a continuation of the same like general ideas or whatever.
All right. So Final Fantasy type, like this is a new story rather than okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's important as well. Actually, you don't have to have played the first one to enjoy this one.
No, you don't. Okay. I'm waiting for there to be a link in the long story threads, but I doubt there'll be one. If there is one, it'll just kind of be a passing thing and won't even be related to the main story bits. But yeah, so there's these synthetic beings called blades, and they act as your like elemental mastery kind of idea. Okay. And one of the people in your party has like an artificial blade, and he like when they first like show her waking up, it's like the joke is that he wanted her for combat and not for anything else. And then it like pans to his closet, and he has a bunch of like little outfits for her and stuff like that.
Okay.
So there is that. Like, don't get me wrong. There is some, and then the main character and his blade are kind of have a sort of relationship that no one wants to talk about. And he's like, oh no, it's not like that kind of thing, you know.
Okay. Are you playing in English?
I am. Yeah.
Okay.
There is like a Japanese option.
Right. But with subtitles, I guess.
I play in English and all the characters, just like Xenoblade. So the original Xenoblade Chronicles had to be like a petition had to go out for it to get ported to the US.
Mm.
And so but it came out in Europe just fine. So all the characters in the original version are British, like all the voice actors.
Okay.
And so they actually continued that in this game where a lot of the voice actors are British. I think they have a couple of them that aren't, but the main kind of human characters are all British speaking, which is, I think is cool.
Okay.
But some of the blades are English speaking, or not English speaking, but American speaking. So I think they gives a nice balance to the idea, but still have a little bit of callback to the original game.
Okay. Well, obviously the weapons are going to be American. That's not surprising.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So Xenoblade Chronicles 2 recommended. Excellent.
Yep.
There is a game that has been making a little bit of noise recently on Steam. It's one of those games that you know, comes out of nowhere and might become something. So I checked it out. It's called They Are Billions, and it's in early access. And it's not something that is going to be as huge as, you know, PUBG or anything like that, but it's fairly interesting. They only have one mode available for now, and it's a survival mode. But essentially, the game is an RTS, very much in the tradition of RTSs, you know, like StarCraft and others. And what you have to do in the only mode that's available now is build up your town and resist increasingly large waves of zombies invading, trying to destroy your town. So it's kind of a RTS slash little bit of tower defense, but it's very, very much an RTS first, and a tiny little bit of tower defense in the sense that it's more of a resist the invasion mission in an RTS than an actual tower defense type game. And I'm not a big fan of RTSs. Like, it's not something that I'm very much interested in general. But for some reason, this one kind of grabbed me a little bit. It's something that usually, you know, I don't even play more than 5 minutes because I get bored. And here I played a few games that were fairly long. And that were, you know, it's the way the game is structured is motivating for you to keep expanding and trying to manage to get a little bit farther. Like, it's very unlikely that you're going to go to the end of the survival trial, which is a number of days. It's, you know, for me, I'm choosing the 120 days, which spreads out the attacks that would occur in the regular mode of 100 days over a little bit longer time. So it leaves you more time to build up your defenses. You want to just go a little bit further every time. And initially, you're not going to survive the first attack because I have no idea what I'm doing. Like, I played through the StarCraft campaigns, like half of them. So I'm not, it has been years since I played an RTS. So it was like, wait, what? So I need what? Gold and wood and minerals, and what's happening now? And the zombies were like, and I was dead. So
how do I play video games again?
Yeah, exactly. That was me playing They Are Billions. But it's just it's fun. It's surprisingly fun for genre that I am not supposedly not into at all. The graphically, it's okay. The style is steampunkish type. And one of the interesting aspects is the developers were saying they have developed the engine to handle like 20,000 units at the same time. So when you start getting into the later invasions, it is not just a few zombies. Like, it's hordes, and that's where you get into the tower defense type logic, because you have to build up walls and cannons and stuff, and they are billions, and the promotional material for the game is pretty well done. They play on that thing, and so yeah, it's a fun game. It's not the best game ever. It's not something I would recommend anyone who hears about it rushes to buy it. But I think it's a fun little holdover while you're waiting for other bigger games to come out. So it's on Steam Early Access. It's $20, so it's reasonably priced. And you might get a few hours of fun out of it. Another game I tried is the new game from Cellar Door Games, which is the developer of Rogue Legacy, a very well-known title from a few years ago. And it's called, it's not Full Metal Furries, as I thought initially. It's Full Metal Furies. And it's an interesting game, but I think you really need to play it with friends for it to be fun. You basically play one of four character that have different abilities, and you have to progress through a series of top-down view, like three-quarters view level. It's very much a retro graphics, pixelated art type game, kind of like Rogue Legacy was. And it seems like it would be immensely fun if I had people to play it with. And it's not that I don't have friends. I'm sure I could find, but I'm very much of a solo player, and I just can't be bothered finding people at that moment when I have the 1 hour I want to spend.
Okay, Patrick, understand that you don't have friends. It's fine. You don't have to make excuses up for yourself.
Okay, all right. Fair enough, fair enough. So I don't have friends, and so the game isn't super fun, but I can absolutely see how much fun it would be with friends. And the different classes of characters are really different, and you know, it's almost like a fighting game or an Overwatch or, you know, that kind of thing. It feels like it would be super interesting to master all the different types of gameplays for the different characters. So it's also $20. It's fairly cheap. It's also available on Xbox One, by the way. It's probably an excellent couch fun co-op game, as I mentioned earlier. So it's only $20. I think it's worth it if you have friends to play with and you enjoy that type of beat them up, beat them all action type.
And if you haven't played Rogue Legacy yet, I highly recommend it to anyone that wants to give it a try, their last game, because that was an incredible game, and so well controlled and tight to play. It was very satisfying. Well,
I think if someone hasn't played Rogue Legacy yet, I don't know, you know, they should, they're not, they have a problem in their gaming habits. It's been out for years and it's been out on every platform. Rogue Legacy is a good game as well. You also wanted to talk about Hollow Knight?
Yeah, so Hollow Knight is a kind of Metroidvania game that came out, I think, March or April of last year or something like that. But in my, like you said, my lacking of gaming habits, I didn't really get around to it until recently, and I've been playing it on 4Player's stream. And the game is, I don't even know how to talk about it besides just it's great. Like, the combat is simple to start out with, and then you start to get more abilities and more stuff like that. It is hard as balls, like very difficult and not forgiving at all. You can stumble into an area. So one of the mechanics is that when you die, you have to go back and recover your gems or whatever that you use to spend money on, just like kind of Dark Souls kind of idea.
It's very Dark Souls-y in its philosophy, I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
And not so at all the same. As you said, it's a Metroidvania, like 2D side-scrolling platformer type game. But yeah, it's not forgiving.
Yeah, so like you can go into an area and not be able to get out, basically.
Oh, really?
And so Like I got into an area that was intended that was like covered in spikes, and you would think that like, oh, it's covered in spikes, so you probably shouldn't go down there unless you have some ability that can help you with that, right? And I was like, no, I'll go down anyway. So I got to the bottom, and then I got killed by some monster or something like that, and then I realized that I couldn't go back down and then get back up with my gems and stuff like that. So,
I'd lost your gems forever.
It was bad. And then it didn't even matter because I died on the way down to get my guy anyway. So I was just like, screw this, I'm going somewhere else. But there's been a number of, I think I've probably lost about 3,000 gems, which is quite a bit. Like the most expensive thing I can buy right now is 1,800 and everything else is pretty cheap. So that's a lot of gems to lose. But it keeps me coming back, and it's the powers that you get are incredibly satisfying and make you feel stronger every time and stuff like that. So, I highly recommend it to anyone that likes, reminds me very reminiscent of Ori and the Blind Forest as far as it's, maybe not style, but like, it's a gameplay loop. The Hollow Knight, all the characters are bugs, like little insects and stuff like that. So there's a little bit of joy that comes out of like the design of the characters, and the music's great too. So highly recommend.
Yeah, artistically, it's a real achievement. It's very, very well crafted. I have a friend who is the biggest fan of Hollow Knight you will ever meet. He's basically, it's his game of the year. And to be fair, a lot of people considered it as one of the best games of last year. I can't remember if we talked about it on the end of the year episode. Maybe we did. But it's definitely, no, actually, maybe we didn't. But anyway, it's definitely a game worth considering for the people who enjoy that game. It's sort of, I played it for a little bit and sort of got the fun of it, but I thought it wasn't for me, so I stopped. But it is definitely a pretty significant achievement. It's one of those games that if 2017 hadn't been as riddled with incredible experiences, I think it would have stood out even more. But it's still... Yeah. Fairly well known, and
looks like we didn't talk about on Pixels what you talked about on your friend's show.
Yeah, exactly.
With Benoit talked about it, but one last little thing that I'm trying to remember what I was going to say, and I completely forgot it. It's $15. That's it. It's $15 bucks, and it's like a 40-hour game or something like that. So definitely worth like timed hour,
right,
for it.
Right. And the last one I wanted to talk about was Hero Academy 2, which I'm sure many people will remember Hero Academy 1, which was an iPad game by Robot Entertainment. Robot Entertainment is also the company behind Orcs Must Die, if you remember that. And Hero Academy 1 was an awesome asynchronous, complex chess type game, right? It was basically you would get a team of different units that would be put on a board, and you had to kill the other team's, you know, the other player's team. And each team had really different types of abilities. There were like, I don't know, 5-6 different teams, but by the end of the game. Yeah. It was just, it was really a clever implementation of that idea. And so when Hero Academy 2 came out, or when I heard about it, actually it was on Twitter, someone mentioned it to me. I played Hero Academy 1, like we were playing it at Blizzard with my friends like all the time. And the fun thing was you could play a turn and you would have like 4 or 5 games going, and you could play a turn and wait for the others to play their turn. And it was clean. You know, you bought the game, then you bought additional teams if you wanted to, but you didn't have to. Well, Hero Academy 2... I think that's my main comment about the game. It's like, imagine a version of Hero Academy 1 where a team of designers came in and thought, how can we microtransaction this game up the wazoo?
Oh, no.
It has everything. Card packs, gems, gold, like 5 different currencies. And I understand, you know, at the core of the game, I think there is a very intelligent idea to make a follow-up that is not the same as the first one, because there's no point remaking Hero Academy 1. Like, you don't want to make the exact same game. So what they did was you have cards, and each card is either a unit or an ability, and instead of playing it like Hearthstone, where you put the cards on the board, then you just, you know, attack what's in front of you, you actually have a board which is a checkered board. So you position your units, and they have to move, and they have different abilities, and there's a turn-based strategy and card game, collectible card game hybrid at the core of it, which is really, like, imagine Hearthstone if you had to place your units on a chessboard, right? And they had different abilities depending on that. So that idea, I think, is very compelling. But the way it's done is the worst, like, implementation of free-to-play. Like, when you start, the tutorial is that kind of, you don't understand anything. You just have a voice show up and tell you, now click on this icon.
Now do this.
And the icon is yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The icon is glowing and you can't do anything else. And it says, now place your hero here. And it's like the laziest. And I understand they work, you know, some of those do work through sheer force of marketing and sometimes quality of the game, but maybe the game is super fun behind it, and maybe it's balanced, and maybe you don't have to pay a lot of money, and maybe I'm going to spend a little bit of time exploring it a little bit further. But the initial impression, it is so disappointing to see that that's the way they've chosen to do it. So, I don't know. Well, yeah, maybe I'll play a little bit more and give it more of a fair shake. But so far, I mean, the initial impression is really disappointing. So we'll see. So anyway, those were the games we wanted to talk about. And let's finish up with a few tidbits of news. The first one is another bit of disappointment. And that one is with Bungie. That is managing to, you know, I was joking on Twitter earlier. I was saying, I know how fool me once goes, and I know how fool me twice goes, but I wonder how fool me 174 times goes. And that is basically where we are with Bungie right now. They have consistently been disappointing their community on Destiny 2 since the release of the game, with you know, disappointing end game, which is one thing, but also hidden counters that would limit the amount of stuff you could earn, which could be explained if they had been, you know, open about it initially and explained why they were doing things and maybe corrected the little missteps. But this has been happening maybe, you know, every 2 weeks you have a new instance of something going wrong with Destiny 2 and Bungie having to come out. Like, it's getting into meme status now. They come out and they say, we're sorry, this is not how we intended it to be implemented, and we're listening and we're going to do better. And you're like, dude, at some point, and they just had, like, a couple of weeks ago, a big community-focused communication piece where they were saying, we know we messed up on this, and we know we had issues with this and that. We're going to do better. We're going to, you know, improve this aspect and that aspect, and this is what we're thinking of changing here and there. And a week later, or 2 weeks later, they have another fumble with it's the faction rally now, which it doesn't really even matter what it is. It's just another instance of them having to come out and apologize for something. And, you know, it would be bad if it was the first time, you know, the first game, but they had similar-ish issues, even less actually, with Destiny 1. So it's like, you look at this, and as I said in the end of year episode, you look at Destiny 1 and in Destiny 2, and it seems like they have learned nothing. And they're doing... Anyway, I'm so disappointed and so saddened by what's been happening with Destiny 2 and Bungie as a company. And this is not Activision. You know, this is not... I know some people might be willing to blame the big corporate overlord, and certainly they might have some influence on the way some things are going. But the core of the design of it is problematic with this game. And I think we're going to see someone in a few months, you know, I'm wondering if, well, I don't want to say any names because I don't know who's responsible for anything, but I think someone is going to take the fall. And in a few months, we're going to see someone leave the company and it's going to be very corporate and very polite and very kind. And everyone is going to be like, we value the contributions of blah, 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 that they have been, you know, contributing to the game for years. And we wish them the best in the future. But they're good. Everyone will know what it will be. So,
yeah, and I think I agree with you that at a certain point you got to put the blame on Bungie and themselves, just because of like Activision. Sure, I'm sure they have some control over things, but their control over Blizzard doesn't seem to be like super like hand-holdy or anything like that. So at a certain point, you got to lay the blame at Bungie's feet themselves in order to maybe have some accountability for what their poor decisions.
Yeah, I mean, Activision can say things like, we want you to make this a constant revenue stream, right? We want you to be able to microtransaction this game and be able to make it not just one $60 game every year. We need to have more than this in order to, you know, to give you the budget you need. All right, that might lead to some poor decision making. The Battlefront 2 was an example of EA probably pushing for implementations that were detrimental to the game in the end. I think that's believable. In the case of Destiny 2, the core of the issues are not just the implementation of the microtransaction nature of the revenue model. In the case of Destiny 2, there are some core decisions for the design of the game underlying the monetizationizability of the game that are also at fault. And communications-wise, it's like half of the things that have been problematic in the game are things that if Bungie had been more open about it and explained why they were doing some of the things they were doing, it would have been much less of an issue. Like, they give you an opportunity in an event to accumulate a certain, you know, certain items from the game or a certain currency. And because they don't want people to farm the same activity over and over and over again, they bring in diminishing return for that activity in regards to the currency. That's fine. I think it's okay to say to do so if you say it. But you can't give an event where you tell people, well, you're going to be able to earn this, and secretly, after they do it three times, then they have no chance of earning it anymore, and not saying it. Then you say, hey, in order for people to do varied activities, here's what the limits we have in place are. It's, and doing it once is bad enough. Doing it like 3-4 times over the course of 2 months, I don't, it's like there is something seriously rotten in the kingdom of Bungie. So anyway, disappointment. Well, Epic Games is also disappointed with one of its flagship games, or what they would have liked to be a flagship game, and that's Paragon. It's funny because Paragon was pushed last year, the year before, as this big initiative from Epic for the 3D, you know, MOBA type that they would basically bring MOBAs into the 3D third person view world. And obviously Paragon has not known a huge amount of success. It was, you know, bundled in the hero shooter explosion of 2016, so it had a lot of competition and there were a lot of entrants and very few winners in that category. But they were still pushing the game until the end of last year, and they were saying, yes, the future is bright for Paragon. And a few weeks later, they're like, so here's the deal. Fortnite is really working out for us, and Paragon not so much. So we're not sure Paragon is something we're going to keep pushing so much anymore. So basically, they're letting people down easy. It's interesting to read because they're saying none of the novel concepts we introduced in Paragon resonated enough with the community for it to be a breakout success. And so it's now languishing with a poor population. They're being very realistic about what the game is and why it didn't catch up. And on the other hand, they have Fortnite, which wasn't going anywhere, but with the addition of the Battle Royale mode has become a very successful game. And yeah, they're being realistic. They're like, well, we have this thing and we have this other thing and that other thing is working out. So let's push the thing that is working out. It makes sense. It's just a little bit sad for Paragon. But Epic is I think, ending up a winner on that equation. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Have you been playing Fortnite Battle Royale?
No, I haven't been playing it at all. I think we talked about the PUBG and the zeitgeist around that.
Right.
How I was interested in the idea, but it wasn't something that was like really pulling me out to full out go out and buy the game at that moment. So,
well, Fortnite is free to play, and I think that is. I mean, the Battle Royale mode is free to play, and that's mm-hmm. a big factor in its success. I think a lot of people on PlayStation, especially because PUBG is not available on PlayStation, but on all platforms, a lot of people are taking the opportunity to try out this mode. And I don't know if we mentioned it, but Paladins is. Oh yeah, I mentioned it last episode. Paladins is also adding a Battle Royale mode, so. I think they're calling it Battleground, actually. So
now we just need Overwatch too.
Overwatch?
Overwatch to add one.
Oh, we just need Overwatch to add a Battle Royale mode, right?
Yeah.
I think that might be a really fun, if they manage to find a way. I think that's what I was saying about Paladins. Hero shooters are a little bit different because you need progression throughout the 20-40 minutes of the game. So you need additional abilities. And I don't know how that works in a hero shooter, and I don't know that it will work in Overwatch, but it would be interesting to see what would happen if they tried their hand at something like this.
Yep.
Fable is a game people like, or a series people remember fondly, and apparently the people at Microsoft think that it might be worth bringing it back. Obviously, the franchise was launched by... the name escapes me.
Lionhead.
Lionhead, thank you, which was closed in 2016. And now, apparently, according to the rumors, Microsoft saw the success of Horizon Zero Dawn, and they were like, maybe single-player games are not such a bad idea after all, the big open-world single-player games, because Microsoft was basically saying, we don't do that anymore.
They canceled Scalebound and Fable in the same like couple months span.
Mm-hmm. Fable Legends, right?
No, I think they shuttered Lionhead completely.
Right. But that was a while ago. That was like 2016. That was 2 years ago. But
It was at the same time that they closed down the Scalebound project.
Oh no, I thought that was last year.
Or was that last year?
Yeah, I think so. Anyway,
you're right.
The developer for this version would be the company behind Forza Horizon, and again, I can't remember the name of that. Developer
that I do not have.
it must be somewhere in the article I'm looking at, but I can't find it. I will. Sorry, but yeah. So it's. I can imagine that they would have gotten some people from Lionhead now, and they're like, oh, oops. Okay, well, maybe we can do something with this. And I never played Fable, but I know it is very popular with a huge part of the gaming population. So I think this is the kind of thing that Microsoft needs. And I hope that we're seeing this happen as a consequence of Phil Spencer gaining, you know, ranks and power in the Microsoft organization. And so he's able to push some of those big beacon titles for development in the company, and we'll see those happen more and more. So that's good news. What else? Metal Gear Survive, we have a trailer for that thing. So Metal Gear Survive is a game by Konami post Hideo Kojima, the, of course, creator of Metal Gear, which is basically, it seems like it's a betrayal of everything Metal Gear and Kojima stood for. It's so different that it almost feels like it's a thing that Konami put together out of spite for Kojima. Like, I don't think it's the case, but that's what it feels like. It's essentially, the trailer makes it look like Orcs Must Die, which I referenced earlier, which is essentially a tower defense third-person view game. I don't think that game is going to... Maybe it's going to surprise me, but I don't know. What do you think?
I think that the gameplay of Metal Gear Solid 5 was, like, solid, right? So taking that gameplay and that engine and putting it into something else is a good, like, business decision. I just think that Konami has soured people on their perceived treatment of Kojima. And I just don't think this game will kind of do anything. I think there'll be some people that kind of don't follow the news of the video game industry, like, very closely, that will see this and be like, oh, that Metal Gear game, I know that game, and they'll probably buy it, and it probably will be a well put together game for, like, being a tower defense game. But I just don't see it appealing to me or really anyone else that knows the story and the history behind it, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are not going to... I think people will review it fairly, and it does obviously add some brand recognition if you call it Metal Gear rather than you... You know, if they had called it Zombie Invasion Party, it would have been, like, a lot less... it would have gotten a lot less publicity. So, yeah, as you said, from a marketing standpoint, a business standpoint, it makes sense. I think if it turns out it's a good game, it will be judged fairly. I don't think people are going to just pan it just in the press. You know, the professional people, they're not going to pan it just because it's a Metal Gear game that stabs Kojima in the back. But it doesn't strike me as something that is going to set the world on fire. Something that is setting the world a little bit on fire is the Overwatch League that started last week that has attracted 10 million viewers in its first week. Obviously, the opening week is going to be more successful than the subsequent week until probably the finals. To give you a little bit of context, the finals for the League of Legends competition last year generated 60 million views on the finals game itself. So obviously in the first week, when we're talking about 10 million views for Overwatch, it is a little bit wider because it's not uniques, right? It's cumulative. So it might be actually a million people that watched 10 times on average, or a little bit more that watched a little bit less. And obviously it doesn't compare to something like the biggest esports that has been the biggest esports for years and years, and that manages to create 60 million views for one game. I'm mentioning this because I've seen a lot of comments saying, oh, this is ridiculous compared to X big game like CSGO or League of Legends. That's a pretty unfair comparison. What's interesting is the fact that the launch of the Overwatch League is fairly positive, and people have been getting some positive reactions to it, and they are pretty happy with the production value. They put a lot of money into it, and it shows. There are some weaker points, like people are starting to notice that a lot of the matchups have been very one-sided. A lot of the teams are so much better than the other teams that it's basically 4-0 in the games. But overall, I think it's a really good start, and the quality is definitely there. I mean, the basis of the foundation of the thing is very, very healthy, I think. And there are some things that work a little bit better, some things that work a little bit less well. There are watch point recap videos that they're doing for each week of the season, which I think are a little bit gimmicky at times and could be a great way of keeping up with what's happening in the league without having to watch all of the multi-hour games. But it's overall, I think it was very enjoyable. I hope that we see in the season two or season three, I really hope we see European and, well, Asian for the Asians. I care a little bit less, but European divisions so that I can root for my local team and that I can have games at a time where I can actually watch them and not in the middle of the night and I have to catch the VODs the day after. So yeah, I think I'm going to be watching a few games here and there, and definitely when the finals come around, you know, the final championship for the whatever session name they have, I'm definitely going to be watching that for sure. So
yeah, did you get a chance? I agree to with you.
Yeah,
I did a little bit, a couple of like smaller matches, not really like an entire match. I didn't watch, but I like that there's the built-in like functionality in the game to watch it. I like that they're kind of have like a built-in connection to the game where you can like basically get different team colors and stuff like that, which I think is cool.
Well, you can. I didn't mention it. You do have an Overwatch League tab on the Blizzard launcher now, which obviously is going to bring a lot of people. When the games are live, you have a menu flashing in game that tells you, "Hey, the Overwatch League is live." You can click, and it brings you to that. To that page. So obviously that's a lot of views as well. And you can buy in the game now, you can buy uniforms. So basically colors for the different heroes that fit the different teams from the league. So that's also a big synergy with the game itself.
Yeah, it's kind of, I don't know. I think it's interesting the way they did the colors. They give you one free one that you can unlock on one character. And then you can buy like points, obviously, to kind of unlock others. And I think you can earn them too through normal gameplay.
No, you can't actually. You have to.
Oh, you can't. Those. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I was wondering about that. So the only way you can get those things is to buy like what looks like loot boxes, but basically they're just giving you a bunch of points that you can then spend. Yeah. So it's not like an actual loot box.
No, it's not a loot box. It's really just points. So it's really a currency for money. So the money goes to Blizzard and the teams. Yeah.
Is there any alternative way to earn that currency at all?
Think so.
Or is it just,
no. Yeah, I mean, okay. Blizzard can, you know, award it for events and stuff like that, but no, you can't play, you can't earn it through in-game anything. So it's really a way to, like, it's like buying a jersey from a team in a store.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, so there's that. Finally, there is a partnership between Ubisoft and LEGO, with Tencent, which is an interesting little thing that I thought I'd mention.
Wow, that's a weird combination of things.
Yeah, it is. It is. I think we've heard about it a little bit more in France because Ubisoft, of course. But I mean, Tencent, I wonder if they're going to be targeting the Chinese market specifically, or if it's going to come out elsewhere. I'm guessing it's probably going to be coming out in France as well, in other platforms. What they're talking about WeChat gaming and stuff like that. So we'll see. It's probably going to be mobile because, you know, Tencent is focused on China. But yeah, Ubisoft going in that direction is really interesting. Working with LEGO, that has traditionally been, I think they've been doing stuff for with Warner Brothers, right? Because all of the Lord of the Rings and DC LEGO games. So it's another direction. I wonder what's going to happen there. And LEGO definitely has a huge potential in gaming, and they've been exploring it very successfully in the past few years, but maybe Ubisoft could take them in a different direction. And Ubisoft has been quite successful as well in recent history. So yeah, looking forward to that as well. And that is going to be it for this episode of the show. That I don't know when I'm going to be coming back, but I'm glad that we got to do this one and round up a little bit of what has been happening. So if people want more of Ed, where would they find you?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Edesis. That will obviously be in the show notes as usual. If you want to watch me stream live, I stream live Wednesday nights at about 9 o'clock Eastern time on 4pp.tv. And we stream every night, and we have our podcast that I'm not on, but the rest of the group is, every Thursday night. And then keep an eye out on our YouTube channel for our upcoming top 10 games of the year, which you got a preview on last time I was on, but maybe the bottom five will surprise you. So keep an eye out for that.
Cool. Thank you very much. I am Not Patrick on Twitter and on Facebook. If you want to keep up with what's happening in my life, you can follow me there. Of course, you can find this show on frenchspin.com. You'll also find other shows like the Phileas Club. Well, one other show like the Phileas Club, which is a show about what's happening in the world, and we get people from different parts of the world to talk about it. So we get different opinions and angles and cultures. So that is interesting to some people as well. And yeah, that's about it. We will probably be taking a little break of one episode, I think, to take care of diapers. Hopefully at some point the baby will decide to come out, and we'll be back fairly soon after that with lots of stories to tell. So I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I will talk to you when we come back. Bye.
Later.